Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. There is no more valuable commodity in the West than water. In fact, to call it a commodity is to misstate reality. Without water, we perish. It follows that having assured access to the use of water is vital. For 30 years, the Confederated Salish Kootenai tribes in the state of Montana have disagreed about tribal claims of reserved water rights. After a decade of negotiations, the 2015 legislature approved, and Governor Bullock signed into law, a comprehensive agreement. Melissa Hornbein was the lead attorney for Montana. Melissa, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for having me.
Before we discuss the complexities of that very interesting case, tell us a little about your background. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up just outside of Seattle, Washington. My parents were both doctors. My father was an anesthesiologist. My mom was a pediatrician. And went to school in the Pacific Northwest and had a career in field botany before I decided to go back to law school.
Now that's a switch. So tell us, why field botany? What interested you about it?
I grew up spending a lot of time in the outdoors of the Pacific Northwest. My father's a climber. I really grew up valuing the outdoors, and I wanted to do something in the professional world that would let me be outside. Botany did that. It also brought me to Montana. I worked in Glacier Park for a number of years, and it was an incredibly rewarding thing to do.
Then why the switch to law?
I realized after 6 or 7 years in the natural resources field that I was going to have to go back to school, either graduate school in biological sciences or do something else. I had always had a facility for language and liked reading and writing. I was also spending 50 and 60 hour weeks on my feet hiking to the point where I wasn't enjoying doing it so much for recreation anymore. And I was interested in the natural world and the way law and policy played into the natural world. So law seemed like a natural outlet for that.
When you studied law, did the actual material you learned surprise you in any way in terms of your expectations going in?
It did. I had a very difficult time my first year of law school understanding how what I was learning, the basic classes that all law students take, parlayed into my areas of interest in natural resources. Mm-hmm. After the first year, I realized that what I was being taught was not specific subjects so much as a way of thinking. And after that, I enjoyed law school a lot more and realized that really what it's about is learning how to think critically and analytically about a given set of facts.
Your resume says you worked as a law clerk for Montana Supreme Court Justice Brian Morris.
That's correct.
How was that experience?
That was wonderful. It was one of the best jobs I've ever had. Nowhere else in your career do you have the opportunity to work closely with a judge, essentially writing opinions, drafting the opinions that the court puts out, but at the same time having intensive experience learning how to write legally and how to write well. And I certainly got that from then Justice Morris, now Judge Morris.
Not only writing well, but I assume you have to understand who you're writing for.
Absolutely.
So in a way, you have to put yourself in the justice's mind. Fair?
Indeed. And it's very different, as I learned when I transitioned to the state of Montana. It's very different writing as a judge versus writing as an advocate.
In summary form, because the case is a complex one, what does the attorney for the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation do, the position you held for 5 years?
The position I held was really split between two things. I was, on the one hand, a general staff attorney for the Montana DNRC and their trust lands management program, so essentially working as in-house counsel for the agency. What ended up being the much larger part of my job was working as staff attorney for the Montana Reserved Water Rights Compact Commission. And in that role, I was responsible for helping to negotiate water rights settlements both with the tribes and with the federal government over their claims to what are called reserved rights within the state.
Now, you just said something quickly that I didn't get. The title was the
Montana Reserved Water Rights Compact Commission.
What does it do?
The Compact Commission is a 9-member body that was created by the legislature in 1979 to negotiate for the settlement of what are called reserved water rights claims. In other words, water rights claims possessed by the United States government and various Indian tribes within the state. And the point of the commission is to negotiate for the settlement of those claims so that the state doesn't have to litigate them. And moreover, to negotiate in a way that protects the interests of existing state-based water rights holders through that negotiation process.
You said reserved water rights by the United States government and tribes. That suggests that sometime in the long-distant past, rights were reserved for their use, and Montanans came in later.
That's essentially correct, although the key factor here is that the date of the reserved water rights, and you have to take into account that Montana operates on the prior appropriation system for water. So first in time is first in right.
First in time is first in right means what?
That means that a user who has senior rights on a source of water is entitled to use the last drop of his water before a user with a junior, what is called a priority date, a junior first date of water use, is entitled to use the first drop of theirs. So it's critically important to water use in Montana.
Okay, so federal reserved rights and tribal reserved rights date to approximately when?
It depends entirely on the date that the reservation in question was created. In the case that we're talking about here, the Flathead Indian Reservation, that date is July 16th of 1855.
And in 1855, Montana was not a state, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so that would qualify then as an old or senior water right.
Indeed.
So the commission's work, as you said, if I got it right, is to try to resolve these potentially conflicting claims without litigation, the expense and uncertainty of litigation?
That's correct, and to do it in a way that protects existing state-based water users.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking to Melissa Hornbein, lead attorney for the state of Montana in the recent negotiations with the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribe about water rights. Over the last 6 months or so, this particular agreement has received a lot of attention. Have there been precedents, other examples of this process working to settlement?
Certainly. The Reserved Water Rights Compact Commission has negotiated 17 prior compacts, 11 with federal agencies and 6 with other tribes within the state of Montana.
In terms of how many there are to resolve, where does the Salish Kootenai one stay?
This is the final compact to be resolved.
Okay. Sketch out for us the issue. In other words, it has to do with water, but how much water? On the reservation, limited? Tell us about it.
This tribe's water rights claims are unique, and the reason for that is that the 1855 Treaty of Hellgate was unique in that it not only reserves for the tribes the reservation lands, but it also reserves for the tribes the ability to access all usual and accustomed fishing grounds off of the reservation. The tribes have a very strong legal argument that that equates to water rights off of the reservation as well as on reservation.
That phrase, usual and accustomed, is in the treaty?
That is in Article 3 of the Hellgate Treaty.
Okay.
As well as 14 other treaties that were negotiated by the territorial governor, Isaac Stevens.
All right. Now, Mike's limited experience as a lawyer would be that that language has real significance before courts. Fair or unfair conclusion?
That's certainly correct. The U.S. Supreme Court has held on at least 7 separate occasions that that right to access usual and accustomed places means more than a right that is equal to what non-Indians possess. It's something more. We don't know exactly what, but it certainly includes a right of access across private property as well as a right to harvest a proportional share of the fishery.
So in summary form, what's the track record of appellate courts in assessing tribal interests in these kind of conflicts?
You know, it really depends on the court and the region, but the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently upheld tribal water rights in particular and tribal treaty rights in general. And in fact, they apply a special set of rules that, of course, all lower courts have to follow as well, which is that the treaties must be interpreted as the tribes would have understood them at the time. And if there's any ambiguity, that ambiguity must be construed in the light most favorable to the tribes.
All right, so if you're an attorney negotiating an agreement and you have that background of appellate decision coming from the United States Supreme Court, I assume you take its implications seriously in terms of negotiations.
Absolutely. It underscores all of the negotiations from the state's perspective, because if this issue were to come before the courts must apply those rules of federal treaty interpretation.
Okay, one other question. The language is fairly broad. When I think, what little I know about modern water rights, they're very quantified. This sounds much more broad. Am I mistaken?
No, that's correct. In fact, in the first case in which the U.S. Supreme Court recognized these types of reserved rights, that was a case that arose out of a dispute over the Milk River, waters of the Milk River here in Montana. And the court said that even though the treaty at issue in that case did not mention the word water, it would have defied reason to have said that the United States reserved for the tribes this land without simultaneously reserving water to fulfill the purpose of the reservation.
So they implied the right of water.
Absolutely.
So who are the non-native users that would be concerned about a settlement or litigation?
With regard to this particular negotiation, that is a very broad class of users. Certainly, the on-reservation, non-tribal irrigators on the Flathead Reservation get a lot of attention, and they have significant water use. In addition, the users that we had to take into account and try to write protections into the agreement for in negotiations were all municipal and domestic water users, both on and off the reservation, that could be affected by the tribal claims, as well as other irrigation users off the reservation.
Off the reservation is a big territory. How much of Montana are we talking about?
Well, in the compact itself, 11 water court basins have tribal water rights that would be quantified in them. In the absence of a compact, the tribes have expressed the intention to file water rights claims as far east of the Continental Divide as the Upper Musselshell River.
So a big chunk of Montana conceptually could be affected by litigation?
In theory, yes.
That is hard for me to get my head around. Off and on the reservation, I can think, okay, there are some boundaries. On the reservation, do we have any sense of quantity in terms of acre feet or flow or what we're talking about?
That's a great question, and it's usually the first question that people ask. They want to put a number to these types of water rights. That's very difficult in all of these compact negotiations, particularly in this one, because the emphasis is so heavily placed on in-stream flows for fisheries that we have multiple water rights. For example, out of more than two dozen streams coming out of the Mission Mountains, there are in-stream flow water rights for fisheries. The enforcement points are set above existing uses, so they can't impact existing uses. That was a negotiated concession by the tribes. But one of the problems you face in trying to come up with a single number is that when you add up cubic feet per second, as well as acre feet, how water is measured in volume for what are called consumptive uses like irrigation,
right,
you can't come up with a single number. It's like apples and oranges. Moreover, if you have multiple in-stream flow water rights that are measured in cubic feet per second, the water on an upper stream, that same water will satisfy an in-stream flow right on a lower reach of that stream or a different stream in the same basin. So you'd be counting the same water twice.
The last sentence about upper and lower, can you explain that to me a little slower in terms I can understand?
Certainly. So the way that we look at water quantification in Montana is on a hydrologic basin scale. There can be multiple streams or water bodies in a single hydrologic basin that could, in theory, have an in-stream flow water right for fisheries on them.
All right.
For example, if you have a 10 cubic foot per second water right for a fishery at the top of the basin and that water right satisfied, and then you have a stream lower in the basin or a stream reach lower in the basin that has a 5 cubic foot per second water right, that same cubic feet per second that satisfied the upper right is going to satisfy the lower right. So one way to explain it is that if you were to add up all of the speed limit signs between here and Missoula, you could come up with a number, but it wouldn't tell you anything about what the speed limit was actually doing between here and Missoula.
You mentioned as a concerned party municipal users. Can you give me a concrete example of what we're talking about?
On the reservation, the city of Polson is a municipal water user who is likely to need to expand their water use as the population grows. Off of the reservation, the city of Missoula is a potentially affected user.
And irrigators, you said non-tribal members irrigating on the reservation?
Yes, the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project primarily serves non-Indian irrigators. So they are a potentially large population that could be impacted by the tribe's water rights claims. And in fact, they already have been. In 1987, the tribes won a case saying that their in-stream flow water rights must be senior to and must be satisfied before the on-reservation irrigation rights.
What were the concrete consequences, if any, of that decision?
So that 1987 decision that I referenced resulted in what are called interim in-stream flows on the reservation. Those have been in place for a number of years since that decision. They have had to be satisfied prior to the irrigation project rights being satisfied.
Let me just see if I understand you. There has to be, if there's in-stream flow requirements, there have to be quantifiable in-stream flows existent at the time before irrigation can take place.
Yes, those are what are called the interim in-stream flows.
Okay. And so from the standpoint of a farmer who's dependent on the irrigation for his or her crops, that's a very serious decision.
Yes, and in dry years, they have already felt the impact of those rights.
Which raises another question. Your commission represents, if I understood you correctly, what I'll call the quote-unquote Montana users that are junior users to the tribe.
Yes, by statute, we negotiate on behalf of the governor's office, but the interests we represent are those of state-based water users.
Okay, sometimes interests say, wait a minute, I have a different point of view. You're giving away too much or give away more of somebody else's because mine are in jeopardy. This sounds, just from the length of time it's been in the works, as a complex negotiation.
Yes.
Can you elaborate, and specifically with the, let's start with the Montana users, how were they represented? How did you talk to them, or did you talk to them? I mean, not you personally, but the commission, to assess different perspectives of their assertions and their negotiating position.
Yes, both in this negotiation as in all of our prior negotiations, we engage in extensive public outreach, not just the negotiating parties collectively, but the state specifically spends a lot of time meeting with non-tribal water users in this case. We did that here. Unlike in other compacts, in 2013, the irrigators actually tried to negotiate a portion of this agreement, the portion dealing with water use on the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project, directly with the tribes. Those negotiations broke down pretty much during the last legislative session and resulted in the compact not passing the 2013 legislature.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Melissa Hornbein, lead attorney for the state of Montana and the recently completed negotiations with the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribe Water Compact.
I just want to clarify the last point I made. The attempt at a negotiated agreement with the on-reservation non-tribal irrigators as a party, the breakdown of those negotiations certainly was not solely responsible for the compact not passing in 2013, but the lack of communication and the lack of a final agreement between the irrigators and the other parties certainly helped to contribute to the failure of the 2013 compact.
Okay. Let's go to this period between that failure and the success in the last legislative session, where there was bipartisan support for the compact and there was a significant opposition to the compact. I'm assuming there were intense emotions involved on multiple sides here, including the tribe, about these questions.
Absolutely.
Were you directly involved in the process of dialogue?
Yes.
How was it?
It varied. In many cases, it was productive, but it was also incredibly frustrating and contentious, and that wasn't just as between compact opponents and the negotiators, but between the negotiating parties themselves. The tribes were incredibly tough negotiators, and discussions often got heated and were very difficult. Ultimately, we were able to come to agreement, but I think sometimes there's a perception that the tribes in the state were on board with everything all along, and that certainly wasn't true.
Just putting on an irrigator's hat for a minute, I would say, I want to use all the water I've got, and I'd like to get some more for potential growth, all right? And I'm darn afraid that you're going to give away the store. Now, when I put on the tribal hat, I might say, look, the law is clear, the language is clear, and we've got the Supreme Court behind us. We have senior rights. We're not going to give up anything. How do you negotiate in that situation? Let's take the tribal point of view. Give us some examples of contentious issues that where they took a position and maybe modified it or didn't.
I think one of the most difficult issues for the tribes involving these discussions about the irrigation project on the reservation was the fact that they have already won a case on this issue. They have a ruling from the Ninth Circuit saying that they have the senior water rights on these streams. From their perspective, what is the incentive to compromise on those in order to protect existing irrigation rights? They actually ended up making significant concessions of what they felt their claims were in terms of quantification of those in-stream flow water rights in order to protect irrigation deliveries, and ultimately they agreed to enter into what is called a shared shortages approach. In other words, under a strict rule of priority, their senior rights would be satisfied first. Under the compact, when water is short in drought years, the tribes and the irrigators would share that shortage.
Okay, that strikes me as a major concession of the tribe in principle and given the previous rulings of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Why did it happen?
I think ultimately the tribe saw the value of a negotiated settlement, also the ability to bring in both state and federal money to repair this very ancient irrigation project and increase its efficiency, then allows for simultaneous protection of irrigation deliveries and increases of tribal in-stream flows. They may be deferred, but probably...
Deferred, I don't understand.
Well, deferred. You have to accomplish the infrastructure upgrades to the project to realize those water savings.
I see. So there was then, in addition to the sharing agreement, and what I'll call an investment agreement, a commitment of funds to upgrade the irrigation system, correct?
Yes.
How much money over what period of time and who's paying the bill?
I can only speak from the state's perspective. There will be a very large federal contribution to settlement, but only Congress can determine what that is. The state's total commitment to this settlement is $55 million. Of that, $42 million goes directly to the irrigation project, therefore benefiting both tribal and non-tribal irrigators.
All right, so that sounds to me a serious incentive in terms of having water is one thing. Having use of water through a viable irrigation system with the money to back it up is another.
Yes.
I did some facilitation with the tribe on the issue of lake trout some years ago, and I got the very strong impression that the integrity of the fishery was of fundamental cultural importance to them as a people. Was that your impression, and if it was, do you feel they felt satisfied with the result of the compact in that respect?
That is certainly my impression. Throughout our negotiations, the focus on fishery health not only was in relation to the tribe's duty to meet requirements under the ESA, but much more so as a result of an intense cultural value for that resource. So I think that was of critical importance to them. I think that in the compact, they recognized a negotiated solution that provided for protections for that those fisheries and their improvement over time. I know with almost certainty that certain members of these tribes feel that they could have gotten more in the way of water for fisheries through litigation. And that was something that the tribe struggled with throughout these negotiations.
And how about folks on the other side who objected? What was the argument of those users, non-native users, against the compact, the key argument?
I'm going to try and convey what they represented as their argument, which was twofold, really. It was that they were worried about private property rights, existing private property rights being taken away somehow. Mm-hmm. And secondly, they were also worried about not enough water to the irrigation project. So I believe those were their two primary concerns. Looking at it from my perspective as an attorney for the state, I felt that the concern about private property was the one that drove the bus at the end of the day.
Private property is a highly emotional, cultural, embedded value in the, let's call it the settler culture. Would you say that that emotional issue played a role in this?
Absolutely. Water is the lifeblood of many of the people we're talking about, whether they're tribal or non-tribal. At the same time, the non-tribal irrigators as well as other non-tribal water users view their water right as a private property right, which as a matter of law, it is. But it's very hard to disentangle those legal recognitions of property rights from the emotional tie that people have to what they perceive as their property rights.
And I assume to get them to fully absorb the significance of the precedential court decisions.
That was very difficult. Many of the comments we received were, well, we understand the courts may have said that, but we don't agree with it.
You personally have been involved in these negotiations for how long?
The past 2 years.
How has it been as an experience for you as an attorney in terms of what you learned that you didn't know going in?
It's been a pretty incredible experience for me. I negotiated 2 federal compacts prior to this one. Both of those were difficult and contentious, but nothing compared to this one. So the difficulty of negotiating both with another sovereign, the tribal government, as well as the United States, and also dealing with these very strong feelings possessed by non-tribal members on both sides of the issue was a real revelation for me.
Revelation how?
As attorneys in law school, we're taught to think that the law defines the parameters of any situation that you approach from a legal perspective. In this situation, yes, the law is certainly an underlying constant, but the level of emotional involvement on all sides is something that has to be taken into account in any negotiation. And that was the revelation for me, was that as a very analytical person, as a lawyer, I had to take into account not only the underlying legal background, but also the emotional investment of everyone involved.
I understand the bill is something like 140 pages. In 30 seconds, can you tell the people of Montana why you think it's a good deal for them?
The compact protects existing state-based water rights. It recognizes the tribes' federal and tribal reserved water rights, which we have a federal legal obligation to do, and it provides a framework for water use in western Montana that will carry us forward and allow for the development of communities and the protection of fisheries throughout a large portion of the state.
So in a nutshell, you're saying good for the non-native people, good for the native people.
I believe so.
Melissa Hornbein, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week.
Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.